you're seated in the section to my left, you will exit out the bronze gate to your right. If you're seated in the center or the right section, you will exit out the main doors located at the rear of the courtroom. If you see anything suspicious, alert a police officer. And in the event of an emergency, please remain calm and listen to the instructions given to you by a police officer. Thank you.
The Honorable, the Chief Justice and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. Oyez, 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 all persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Justice Jackson has the opinion of the court this morning in case 23-1345, Rivers against Guerrero.
Incarcerated individuals are generally afforded one fair opportunity to challenge their imprisonment through a federal habeas petition. But, as we have said before, when a prisoner seeks to bring a subsequent federal habeas challenge, the road gets rockier. That is because, under the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, or AEDPA, second or successive habeas corpus applications face significant procedural hurdles. For example, such petitions cannot raise previously presented claims, and they cannot present new claims without the filer having first obtained the Court of Appeals authorization to file and meeting strict substantive requirements. Also, AEDPA's restrictions apply whether or not the prisoner calls the subsequent filing a habeas petition. Regardless of the label, if the new submission is a second or successive application, AEDPA's filing restrictions are applicable. This case presents the question of when AEDPA's second or successive restrictions kick in. Specifically, do those restrictions apply to a second-in-time habeas filing when the district court has entered a judgment denying the first application on the merits, but that judgment is still under review on appeal? We hold today that, in general, a second-in-time habeas petition qualifies as a second or successive application if the district court has entered a judgment with respect to the first habeas petition, regardless of its status on appeal. Petitioner Danny Rivas was convicted of various state court offenses and incarcerated. In 2017, a federal district court denied Rivers' first habeas petition on the merits. He appealed that denial to the Fifth Circuit. While his appeal was pending, Rivers discovered new evidence and filed a second habeas petition, presenting that evidence and new claims regarding it in the federal district court. The district court classified that second-in-time habeas filing as a second or successive application under AEDPA and transferred it to the Fifth Circuit for authorization to file. But Rivers appealed the transfer, arguing that the filing was not a second or successive petition because his first petition remained on appeal. The Fifth Circuit affirmed the district court's treatment of the second-in-time petition. In its view, entry of the judgment on the first petition was what marked the dividing line for second or successive treatment, and the fact that the first petition was on appeal did not affect that characterization. The Fifth Circuit's decision entrenched a circuit split over how to characterize second-in-time habeas applications filed while an appeal is pending on the first application. We granted certiorari to resolve that split, and as noted, we hold today that it is the entry of judgment, not the conclusion of appellate review, that demarcates second or successive applications. In reaching this conclusion, we reject the primary argument from Rivers' petition for certiorari, which frames this debate as being one about timing. He says that a second-in-time petition cannot be characterized as a second or successive application until the conclusion of appellate review of the first petition. Respondent disagrees. It asserts that a new petition filed after the district court's judgment is entered with respect to the first petition qualifies as a second or successive application under AEDPA. We generally agree with respondent. Our case law compels the conclusion that judgment is the relevant event, not the conclusion of appellate review. We've already explained, for example, that an amended petition filed after the initial application but before judgment on the first petition is not second or successive because final judgment has not issued. On the other hand, a motion for relief from judgment under Federal Rule of Procedure 60B, filed obviously after judgment has issued, counts as a second or successive application if the filing, for example, seeks to add a new ground for relief not addressed by the initial judgment. Rivers points to a case in which we held that Rule 59E motions to alter or amend a judgment related to a first habeas petition are not second or successive, even though they are filed after the judgment. But Rule 59E motions present a unique variant to the generally applicable rule and they do not qualify as a second or successive petition because they suspend finality of the initial judgment and help to produce a single final judgment for appeal. Rivers' citations to history and policy also fail to persuade us that he has the better argument. By enacting AEDPA's restrictions, Congress chose to promote finality and avoid piecemeal litigation, which Rivers' view would undermine. Moreover, pre-AEDPA case law is inconclusive about when a subsequent habeas filing was dismissed as abuse of the writ, rather than being considered on the merits, and thus is not dispositive. Undaunted, Rivers' merits briefing pivots to an alternative theory, that second-in-time filings that specifically request amendment of an initial habeas petition do not, by their nature, qualify as applications subject to AEDPA's second or successive restrictions. But Rivers failed to present this argument in his petition for certiorari and did not raise it in the courts below. Moreover, his case does not present the factual predicates necessary to support this theory. Thus, we decline to address his alternative argument. For these reasons and others we lay out in our opinion, the judgment of the Fifth Circuit is affirmed. The court's decision is unanimous.
Justice Barrett has the opinion of the court in 24-416, Commissioner of Internal Revenue versus Zook.
The IRS can levy on the taxpayer's property, in other words, seize and sell it to satisfy the debt. Before the IRS does so, however, the taxpayer is entitled to a hearing before an appeals officer, and the taxpayer can seek review of the appeal officer's ultimate determination in the U.S. tax court. This case presents a wrinkle. What happens if the IRS stops pursuing a levy while a case is on appeal before the tax court? Can the tax court still resolve disagreements between the IRS and the taxpayer? Today we hold the answer is no. The case arose like this. Jennifer Zook and the IRS disagreed about whether she had paid the IRS the taxes she owed. The IRS told Zook it would impose a levy, and Zook asked for a hearing. The appeals officer ruled against her, so Zook went to the tax court. Proceedings in the tax court took several years, and during this period, Zook filed several yearly tax returns showing that she was entitled to a refund. But the IRS did not give her a refund. Instead, it took her overpayments and applied them to reduce the balance on Zook's unpaid taxes. Eventually, the balance hit zero. At this point, the IRS asked the tax court to dismiss the case. Because Zook no longer had unpaid taxes, the IRS said there was no longer any reason for a levy. And because the IRS wasn't pursuing a levy, the tax court lacked jurisdiction to resolve Zook's disputes with the IRS. The tax court agreed and dismissed the case. Zook appealed to the Third Circuit. She wanted the tax court to resolve whether she had owed money to the IRS in the first place, because if she hadn't, Zook said, she was entitled to the refunds and the IRS should pay her back. The Third Circuit agreed with Zook and held that the tax court retained jurisdiction even when there was no longer any possibility of a levy. The government asked us to review that holding. Having heard the case, we agree with the government. The relevant provision of the tax code gives the tax court jurisdiction to review a determination, that's the statutory term, made by an appeals officer. And the statute suggests that a determination is just a decision by an appeals officer about whether a levy can go forward. So while the tax court may review whether that decision was right or wrong, it cannot opine on disputes between the taxpayer and the IRS outside the context of a proposed levy. This makes sense. When taxpayers have a dispute with the IRS, they usually must pay the disputed taxes first and then sue for a refund later. The tax code provides a limited exception when the IRS is seeking a levy. But when the levy goes away, the exception goes away too. Accordingly, we conclude that the tax court lacked jurisdiction to resolve Zook's disputes with the IRS once the IRS was no longer seeking a levy. Because the tax court was right to dismiss the case, we reverse the judgment of the Third Circuit and remand for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. Justice Gorsuch has filed a dissenting opinion.
Justice Gorsuch has the opinion of the court in case 24362, Martin versus United States.
In the pre-dawn hours of October 18, 2017, the FBI raided the wrong house in suburban Atlanta. Officers meant to execute a search and arrest warrant at a suspected gang hideout on Landau Lane. Instead, they stormed a quiet family home on Danville Trace, occupied by Hilliard Cleat, his partner Katrina Martin, and her 7-year-old son. A SWAT team breached the front door and detonated a flashbang grenade. Fearing a home invasion, Mr. Cleat and Miss Martin hid in a bedroom closet. But the officers soon found them, threw them on the ground, and trained their weapons on them. Only then did they realize they were in the wrong house. The cause of the mistake? One of the officers blames his personal GPS device. No one can confirm that account, though, because the officer threw his device away not long after the raid. It seems, too, that the officers neither checked the street sign nor the house number before they launched their raid. Left with personal injuries and property damage, but no compensation, Mr. Cleat and Ms. Martin sued the United States for damages, asserting claims for various negligent and intentional torts. Under background legal principles, the United States enjoys sovereign immunity. That immunity generally precludes suits like this one. But some time ago, Congress adopted the Federal Tort Claims Act, or FTCA for short. That law does two things. First, it waives the government's sovereign immunity and allows suits like this one to proceed. But as it turns out, that waiver itself is subject to 13 exceptions that effectively restore the government's immunity in certain situations. Second, for cases that are not barred by one of those 13 exceptions, the FTCA sets forth a rule of liability. That rule provides that the government may be held accountable on the same terms as a private individual under the law of the place where the misconduct occurred. Most courts apply those directives as written, but the 11th Circuit has adopted an outlier approach to both the FTCA's immunity and its liability rules, an approach that eventually led it to dismiss Mr. Cleat's and Ms. Martin's suit. We took this case to address both of those outlying rules, and we hold that neither is appropriate. I will not bore you with the details of why we reject the 11th Circuit's approach to the FTCA's immunity rules. But the reason why we reject the 11th Circuit's approach to the Act's liability rules might be a little more interesting. Remember, that rule provides that the government may be held to account on the same terms as a private individual under the law of the place where the alleged misconduct occurred. Now, under that rule, you might think that this suit could proceed, surely. After all, any private litigant who launched a nighttime raid on a neighbor's house would be liable under the law of Georgia or likely anywhere else in the country. But the 11th Circuit saw it differently. It believed that a precedent of this court called In re Nagel compelled it to dismiss this suit. To appreciate why that assessment was mistaken, a little background about that extraordinary case might help. In re Nagel involved an affair, a homicide, and a habeas petition. In 1883, Sarah Hill claimed to be the wife of a United States senator named William Sharon and sought a share of his fortune in acrimonious California divorce proceedings. Sharon admitted to an affair, but insisted that Hill had forged the pair's handwritten marriage contract. Hill hired David Terry to represent her. Terry was a former Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court, but had resigned that post after he had killed another U.S. senator in a duel. As the litigation wore on, Hill and Terry, lawyer and client, married. Eventually, the dispute between Hill and Sharon wound up before U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Field while he was riding circuit in California. Now, Terry, the lawyer, and Field were no strangers. They'd in fact served together on the California Supreme Court. Even so, Justice Field issued a devastating ruling against Hill. And as he announced his decision, Hill leapt from her seat, denounced the justice as bought, and had to be carried from the courtroom. Joining the fracas, her husband, Terry, punched a marshal and brandished a Bowie knife. Even after the couple spent time in jail for contempt, they continued to issue threats against Justice Field. All those events found their way into the U.S. reports this way. Aware of the threat that Hill and Terry posed, the U.S. Attorney General ordered Deputy Marshal David Neagle, himself a former chief of police in Tombstone, Arizona, and a contemporary of Wyatt Earp, to accompany Justice Field the next time he rode circuit in California. That decision proved prescient, for Terry soon cornered Justice Field on a train and attacked him. Intervening to protect the justice, Neagle shot and killed Terry. After the shooting, California authorities arrested Neagle and began prosecuting him for murder. Neagle countered by filing a petition for a writ of habeas corpus in federal court seeking his release. When that habeas petition reached this court, the justices agreed the writ should issue. They reasoned that the Constitution's Supremacy Clause shielded Neagle from state criminal charges. Without some such protection, the court concluded, California could effectively frustrate federal law by prosecuting a U.S. Marshal for an act authorized by the laws of the United States and one he had to perform to carry out his duties. Now, as memorable as N. Ray Neagle may be, we do not see how it informs the prosaic task of applying the FTCA as the 11th Circuit thought. The case may stand for the proposition that federal law will sometimes preempt a state criminal law when it conflicts with an officer's duties. But N. Ray Neagle does not speak to a situation where, as here, Congress has expressly bound the federal government to accept liability under state law on the same terms as a private individual. After all, no private individual could deploy N. Ray Neagle to his advantage. It has only ever worked to shield federal officers who are discharging their duties. The upshot? The 11th Circuit was wrong to dismiss this case based on N. Ray Neagle. Accordingly, we vacate its decision and remand the matter for further proceedings. The decision of the court is unanimous. Justice Sotomayor has filed a concurring opinion.
Justice Sotomayor has the opinion of the court in 24-275, Parrish against Honickman.
After a district court enters its judgment in a civil case involving the government, litigants usually have 60 days to appeal. When the judgment does not reach one of the parties on time, however, Congress has allowed district courts to reopen the time for filing an appeal. In this case, a federal district court dismissed petitioner Dante Parrish's wrongful imprisonment suit against the government. Parrish, a federal inmate, did not receive that decision until 3 months after it was entered, at which point he promptly filed a notice of appeal explaining the reason for his delay. The Fourth Circuit construed his notice as a motion to reopen the appeal period, and the district court granted reopening. After that, Parrish thought he was in the clear to proceed with his appeal. The Fourth Circuit, however, held that Parrish should have filed a second notice after the district court granted reopening, so it dismissed the appeal. This court now holds that under the federal reopening statute and the rules of appellate procedure, the first notice of appeal provided notice enough. For over a century, this court has held that a notice of appeal filed too early can convey appellate jurisdiction so long as it makes clear who is appealing, from what judgment, and to what court. When a premature notice is otherwise adequate, courts treat the notice as if it had been filed on time. Nothing in the statute changed this longstanding principle, and the rules of appellate procedure are consistent with it. Thus, the rule remains that appeals should not be dismissed simply because they were filed too early. Here, the only problem with Parrish's notice was that it was filed before the district court granted reopening. So, with respect to the reopened period, the notice came too early. The notice was otherwise adequate, so it should be treated as filed on time. Because the Fourth Circuit held otherwise, this court now reverses the judgment below and remands the case for further proceedings. Justice Jackson filed a concurring opinion in which Justice Thomas joined. Justice Gorsuch filed a dissenting opinion.
Justice Thomas has the opinion of the court in case 24-320, Soto versus United States.
This case comes to us on a writ of certiorari to the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. The Barring Act establishes default settlement procedures for claims against the government and subjects most claims to a 6-year limitations period. But the Act includes an exception. If another law confers authority to settle a claim against the government, that law displaces the Barring Act settlement mechanism, including its limitations period. This case is about whether a statute providing combat-related special compensation, known as CRSC, to qualifying veterans is another law that displaces the Barring Act's default settlement mechanism. Petitioner Simon Soto is a military veteran who applied for CRSC payments in 2016. He was granted retroactive compensation under the statute, but was awarded only 6 years worth of benefits because of the Barring Act's limitations period. Soto sued, arguing that this limitations period did not apply to CRSC claims because the CRSC statute provides its own settlement mechanism and therefore displaces the Barring Act. The district court granted summary judgment to Soto, but the Federal Circuit reversed. In the Federal Circuit's view, the CRSC statute does not explicitly grant settlement authority and therefore cannot displace the Barring Act settlement procedures. In an opinion filed with the clerk today, we reverse. In the context of claims against the government, the authorization to settle a claim requires authority to determine the validity of a claim and the amount of money that the claimant is due. The CRSC statute is a unique, comprehensive benefits regime that confers authority to conduct these core settlement functions. For these reasons and others set forth in our opinion, we reverse the judgment of the Federal Circuit. The opinion of the court is unanimous.
I have the opinion of the court in case 24-249, AJT versus Osea Area Schools. Petitioner is a teenage girl with the rare form of epilepsy that severely limits her physical and cognitive functioning. We refer to her by the initials AJT to protect her anonymity. AJT suffers from seizures that are so frequent in the mornings that she cannot attend school before noon, though she is alert and able to learn from noon until 6 p.m. For the first few years of her schooling, school officials accommodated AJT's condition by permitting her to avoid morning activities and instead receive afternoon and evening instruction. But when AJT's family moved to another state, her new school denied her parents' repeated requests to provide evening instruction. So for 3 years, AJT received only 4 hours of instruction daily, compared to the typical 6.5-hour school day. After even further cuts to AJT's school day were proposed, her parents filed a complaint under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, the IDEA, seeking compensatory education and evening instruction. Federal courts ruled in favor of AJT and her parents. AJT and her parents then sued under the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, and the Rehabilitation Act. Those statutes are not limited to education, but provide general protection against discrimination on the basis of disability. They could provide a permanent injunction, reimbursement for certain costs, and compensatory damages. But AJT and her parents lost this time. For most cases seeking relief for disability discrimination under the ADA and Rehabilitation Act, you can obtain injunctive relief by proving a statutory violation. You can get monetary damages by showing the violation was intentional. But showing deliberate indifference is enough to meet that standard. The Court of Appeals here, however, like several others around the country, held that a different, more rigorous standard applied when the disability discrimination claim, like AJT's, is about educational opportunities. In such a case, you have to show, quote, bad faith or gross misjudgment to get relief, even though the same statutory language is at issue. Now, why the much heavier burden for disability claims at school? Well, some courts reasoned that the education context was different because the IDEA applied there, as well as the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act. Those courts thought that requiring the harder showing of bad faith or gross misjudgment was necessary to, quote, harmonize, end quote, the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act with the IDEA, and to reflect the proper balance between disabled children's rights, state officials' responsibilities, and courts' competence in technical fields. Today we hold that, however well-intentioned, that reasoning is wrong. Congress applied the same statutory language to disability discrimination under the ADA and Rehabilitation Act, regardless of whether the discrimination claim arises from school, work, public facilities, whatever. The laws say they apply to any person aggrieved, and to any qualified individual, without distinction based on where the discrimination occurred, at school or outside the school. Having different rules to harmonize claims under the same statute in different places is plainly for Congress to decide, not the courts. And Congress has made clear that nothing in the IDEA restricts or limits the ability of school children to vindicate their independent ADA and Rehabilitation Act rights. Children with severe disabilities and their parents face daunting challenges. We hold that having to satisfy a more stringent standard of proof than other plaintiffs to establish discrimination under the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act is not one of those challenges. The judgment of the Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit is vacated, and the case is remanded for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. The opinion of the court is unanimous. Justice Thomas has filed a concurring opinion in which Justice Kavanaugh joined. Justice Sotomayor has filed a concurring opinion in which Justice Jackson joined. Mr. Clerk, the court will entertain motions for admission in the bar of the court.
Sophia Carballosa.
Ms. Carballosa.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Bianca Nicole Cardona Melendez of the District of Columbia. I am satisfied she possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and Ms. Melendez will be admitted.
Thank you.
David Fisher.
Mr. Fisher.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Daniel Ryan Kozlowski of the Bar of the District of Columbia. I am satisfied he possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and Mr. Kozlowski will be admitted.
Thomas Quinn.
Mr. Quinn.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of my son, Brian Patrick Quinn, of the Bar of the District of Columbia. I am satisfied he possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and your son will be admitted.
Laura Foggin.
Ms. Foggin.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Daniel Ira Graham, Jr. of the Bar of the State of Illinois. I am satisfied he possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and Mr. Graham will be admitted.
A.E. Dick Howard.
Mr. Howard.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of my nephew, Thomas Landon Howard III, of the Bar of the State of New York. I am satisfied that he possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and your nephew will be admitted.
Stephen Button.
Mr. Button.
Good morning. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of David Felix Huber of the Bar of the State of New York. I am satisfied he possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and Mr. Huber will be admitted.
A group of attorneys from the United States Department of Homeland Security, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, presented by Sabrina Thance.
Ms. Thance.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I move the admission of the following attorneys from the state of Arizona: Fatin Raji Barakat Nice. From California: Aliyah Alanizi Bullock, Lisa Coven, Matthew Thomas Sidebottom. From Colorado: Yaron Cho. Admitted in Connecticut: Elizabeth Ann Parrish. From the District of Columbia: Daryl Anthony Alexander Jr., Adam Lee Hill, Gregory Sequel Hornsby, Lauren Nicole Mattioni, Teresa Michelle Rogers. From the state of Florida: Ansley Branner Peacock. From Louisiana: Whit Protzman. From Maryland: Ajay Bhatt, Dylan Anthony Stackness, Christina Maria Giuliano. Minnesota: Brian Newfus. New Jersey: Catherine June Harvey Boardman. From New York: Rebecca Marie Van Tuzzi, Matthew Edward McMahon, Kenneth Padilla, Elizabeth Armijo Rothwell, Ursula Nicole Simmons. Ohio: Macklin Keith Everly. Texas: Jacqueline Elizabeth Hurd. Virginia: Matthew Edward Sweet. I am satisfied each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted.
A group of attorneys from the Arizona Hispanic Women Lawyers Group and UNIDOS U.S., presented by the Honorable Mary Murguia.
Chief Judge Murguia.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I move the admission of the following attorneys: of the Bar of California, my brother-in-law, Mauro Albert Morales, my nephew, Ryan Jason Murguia, and Raul Francisco Salinas. Of the Bar of Arizona, recently appointed and the newest member of the Arizona Supreme Court, the Honorable Maria Elena Cruz. Arizona State Court Judge, the Honorable Ashley Villaverde Halverson. Jessica Sarah Sanchez, Margarita Silva, and of the Bar of Kansas, my brother, Ramon Murguia. I am satisfied each possesses the necessary qualifications.
The various Murguia relatives and the other applicants will be admitted.
Thank you.
A group of attorneys from Harvard Law School, presented by Trevor Cox.
Mr. Cox.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of the following attorneys: from the Bar of the State of California, Isabel Moren; from the State of Colorado, Mark Carver Gillespie; from the District of Columbia, David Simon Danzik, Brian Timothy Fitzpatrick, Louis Adam Grossman, Nomin Erden Jagdagdorj, Stephen John Kaiser, Radhi Paresh Patel, Rima Sirota. From the state of Florida, Laura Ann Mayer. From the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Gregory Bertram Riley III. From the state of New York, Akuya Foriwa Abu, Patricia K. Bulware Miller, Bridget Kathleen DeVoy, Benzion Shlomo Edelman, Joseph Kindle Hurd III, Harmony Loeb Jones, Rachel Gina Newell, Mary Charlotte Ross, Selene Sheringel Perker. From the state of Oregon, Andrew Walsa Henderson. From the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, Claudia Sofia Delbre Ortiz. From the state of Utah, Commander Eric Scott Nelson. And from the Commonwealth of Virginia, Vitan Kapoor. I am satisfied each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted.
A group of attorneys from the University of Kansas School of Law, presented by Stephen McAllister.
Mr. McAllister.
Mr. Chief, excuse me, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of the following attorneys from the Bar of Colorado, Alice Jean Major, from the Bar of the District of Columbia, Brett Allen Brenner, Sharon Wilma Stevens, from the Bar of Florida, Jeffrey Dwayne Rogers Jr., Jayhawks from the Bar of Kansas, Lori Stanfield Bledsoe, Antonio Rico Cortez, Oscar Patricio Espinoza, Austin Keith Parker, Brett Allen Sitz, Christopher Paul Soba. From the Bar of Missouri, Ashley Akers, Daniel Harris Bowers. From the Bar of New York, Sharon Elena Brett, Kaylee Taylor Trost, and from the Bar of South Carolina, Adrian Gabriel DeJoux. I am satisfied each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted. If all of the applicants will stand, the clerk will administer the oath. But before he does so, I would like to extend to each of you a warm welcome as a member of the bar of this court and an officer of the court.
Raise your right hand, please. Do you solemnly swear that as an attorney and as a counselor of this court, you will conduct yourself uprightly and according to law, and that you will support the Constitution of the United States, so help you God?
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until Wednesday, the 18th of June at 10 o'clock.